Right, we were talking about structure of DNA, and remember that technically speaking, a DNA is really two separate molecules, right? Two separate polynucleotides that exhibit complementarity. That's an important, really important feature of DNA, that it has complementarity. What does that mean? Strands what? Well, it's not really opposite, it's complementary sequences. But what does that specifically mean? Well, a base pair is simply a base on one strand and a base at the same position on the other strand. So it's two overall bases. No, that's a different, also important feature of DNA. But first, let's talk about complementarity.
Do the bases fit together?
Well, in what specific way do they fit together?
ATCG?
Right. A always with T. Adenosine always pairs with thymine and vice versa. Guanine always pairs with cytosine and vice versa, which means if you have A at a certain position, then you're guaranteed to have T at the same position on the other strand, and similarly with G and C. That's strict complementarity. What you were talking about, the fact that the two strands are situated head to tail, meaning that the 5' end on one strand is against the 3' end of the other strand and vice versa, that's called anti-parallel. That's the anti-parallel nature of DNA. They're both important components or characteristics of DNA. Here in slide 8, which is where we left off, you can see why it is not just always pyrimidine with purine, but more stringently, more strictly, it's always A with T and always C with G, because A and T both make two hydrogen bonds, whereas C and G make three each. So that's what always enforces the strict complementarity, unless mistakes happen, which do, and those are called mutations. Let's go on to 9, and talk about why this strict complementarity is so important. It's absolutely important for both of the functions of DNA, which means both for transcription and for replication. What we're going to talk about first is replication. But the reason that complementarity is such a big deal is that if I can see the sequence of a strand of DNA, a single strand, then I can tell you exactly what the sequence is on the other strand, right? Simply because of the rules of complementarity. So here on the left, we have just a little piece of the length. It would obviously be enormously long, but we're looking at a little bit of DNA, meaning both strands of that DNA held together by hydrogen bonds between the nitrogenous bases of the two strands. And if you were to unzip this, which is, remember, why its hydrogen bonds are so important, that they're weak, so that you can unzip the two strands from each other temporarily. And if you were to do that, you can hide one from me, but I can tell you exactly what that sequence is going to be, simply because wherever there's an A, there needs to be a T on the other one that you took away, and so on. Wherever there's a C, there's a G. In other words, strict complementarity allows DNA to work as a code. That sequence, whatever it is, and it can be any sequence of A's, T's, C's, and G's on one strand, designates a specific sequence for the other strand, right? And therefore, because of that, each of the two strands of a DNA is able to stand as a template for how to build a copy of the other one. All right? And that is why DNA has the remarkable feature of being able to self-replicate, to copy itself exactly, because each strand tells you how to build the other strand. It gives you the sequence implicitly using the rules of complementarity. So that's exactly what's happening here. You have separation of the strands, which is pretty easy because those are hydrogen bonds. And just as importantly, you don't want a strand to fall apart because then you would lose all of that information, right? So that's why it's important for the sugar phosphate backbone to be made up of covalent bonds so that it doesn't just fall apart. Only the two become unzipped from each other. And when that happens, this one tells the cell how to build a copy of this, and this other strand tells the cell how to build a copy of the first one. And both of those things happen at the same time. So in this figure and in a few others in this chapter, dark blue is used to denote the original DNA that was there, and light blue is DNA that has just been produced, brand new DNA. And as you see here, once you separate the two strands, the cell is going to read each strand separately and build a brand new light blue strand that is complementary to the one that it's reading. And if that's happening to both of the two original strands, that means you end up with two DNAs, each double-stranded, a complete DNA, in other words, and each of those two DNAs is identical to each other, to the original DNA as well. So you start with one double-stranded DNA, you end up with two identical double-stranded DNAs, identical not only to each other, but to that original DNA. That's the essence of self-replication, which is one of DNA's major jobs, of course. So in 10, we can see that there's multiple ways, theoretically at least, that this could work. As long as you're using the concept of complementarity, it could occur in any one of these three ways. It has to be one of them because there's no other mathematical possibilities. But one model is the so-called conservative model. To conserve means to save, right? In a fully conservative model, what you have here, represented by the dark and light blues on the right, is that you start with an original double-stranded DNA, that's why it's dark blue, and you use the information in that, the complementarity rules, to produce a completely brand new DNA that's double-stranded. Note that that's why it's both strands are light-colored. And the original one is just still there. Both strands are dark blue because it hasn't been changed. All right, and then if you go to another generation, you're always conserving or saving that original DNA, and you're just making totally brand new DNA using its code. All right, the semi-conservative model is only halfway conservative. What that says is that the original double-stranded DNA is separated, and then each strand remains in the new DNA, and a brand new strand is added to it. So each complete double-stranded DNA, each generation, is half old and half new material. Okay, dark blue and light blue both. Well, the only other possibility, mathematically speaking, is the so-called dispersive model, which is also by far the least likely to be true. If you just think about parsimony, the notion of the simplest thing is the thing that actually evolves because it's easiest for it to happen. The dispersive model is kind of a slice and dice technique. No strand is original completely. The double-stranded DNA is here, dark blue. Each strand is cut into pieces, basically, and then new strands are built by putting together old and new DNA, which is why each single strand is partly light blue and partly dark blue. Okay? Has to be one of these three things, logically speaking. So the question, experimentally or scientifically, was which one of these is it? Which one is actually happening? And so in slide 11, we can see the results of an experiment to answer that question. Another important historical experiment. We've looked at others before. Here we're using a labeling technique again, but this case it's not radio labeling like it was for the virus experiment we talked about. This is using heavy nitrogen. Nitrogen 14, nitrogen 15 are isotopes, right? Which means that they're the same element because they have the same number of protons. By definition, that defines the element. But they're isotopes of each other because one of them has an additional neutron compared to the other. that keeps it as nitrogen, chemically speaking, but it's with that additional neutron, it's slightly heavier, right? It has more mass. And therefore, you can take advantage of that. You're not detecting radioactivity to find out where it is. Instead, you can use centrifugation, because centrifugation is going to send the heavier stuff to the bottom of the tube and the lighter stuff will be above it. All right. So the dark blue is a flask here, represents the medium that contains only nitrogen 15. And they just let bacteria undergo several generations, because each time a bacterium splits by mitogenic fission, it first creates new DNA, right? It has to replicate before it divides. And the surroundings have only nitrogen 15 in which to create the new DNA. So that means you let that go for a few rounds, and effectively all of the DNA that's in that flask is labeled with nitrogen 15, heavier stuff. All right, then you take a sample of that and put it into a medium that contains only nitrogen 14 as the nitrogen source. And so when they do the next round of replication, all the new DNA, which has to come from the surroundings, is going to be nitrogen 14 containing. You see what I'm saying? And the original stuff will still have nitrogen 15 in it. This is how they can keep track of the old and the new, the dark blue and the light blue in terms of the coding of these figures. All right, so they did this and then centrifuged the sample. And the idea here, like I said, is that the heavier stuff is going to go to the bottom, lighter stuff is going to float to the top. But let's look at the predictions for the conservative, semi-conservative, and dispersive models. The conservative model says that you should have pieces of DNA that are entirely heavy, right? That original stuff should be both strands, nitrogen 15. And the new stuff should be both strands, nitrogen 14. So you should expect to see, as you see here, two separate bands in your centrifuged tube. The heavier stuff should go to the bottom, the lighter stuff should go to the top. Well, they didn't see that. They found only one band. So right away, the conservative model is disproven. The problem with doing this just for one generation, though, is that both the semi-conservative and the dispersive model predict the same outcome. What they have in common, unlike conservative, is that the DNA should now be half old and half new, exactly, but in different ways, right? They're going to weigh the same, though, if they're both half new and half old. So that predicts just one intermediate band in the centrifuge tube, and they both lead to that prediction coming true. I mean, the experiment came true for both of these. So in other words, it's useful that you can say it's not conservative, but it doesn't pin down whether it's semi-conservative or dispersive. And that's why they had to go another round, that second generation. After you let it divide once, then you let it divide again. And that's because the semi-conservative model on that second round predicts a totally new stuff as one band, and one band that's half old and half new. This corresponds on the previous slide to the rightmost pictures to make sense of it. But the dispersive model, on the other hand, is going to predict still just all one band. It's just that it's going to get higher and higher in the tube each generation, because it's going to be, first of all, half old, half new, then a quarter new and quarter old and three quarters new, and so on. It's always going to be, since each strand is a mixture, it's always going to be one band. So that's not what happened. And what came true was exactly what was predicted for semi-conservative. And that is what actually happens in a cell. It's the semi-conservative model of DNA replication that actually happens. So that leaves us to the specifics of how it actually happens, starting with slide 12. This is kind of an overview of replication in both of the major types of cells, right? The dichotomy of cell types is that there are prokaryotes and there are eukaryotes. They differ in multiple ways that we talked about several times. But in terms of DNA, ignoring all those non-DNA related differences between the two cell types, they also differ in their DNA. Specifically, in a prokaryote, there is a single chromosome, right? One big chromosome, not multiple, like there are in eukaryotes. And it's a circular chromosome. It doesn't have any ends. Wraps around on itself, forms a circle. Whereas in a eukaryotic cell, however many chromosomes there are, which depends on species, each of those chromosomes is linear, two ends. Aside from that, though, the process of replication happens basically the same way in both. Let's look at what's happening at the top, though, using the prokaryote, circular chromosome as an example. It's a circular chromosome, but it's not really as simple as this double circle implies, because it actually is still a helix. So it's twisted as it goes around the circle. This is shown untwisted, just it's easier to look at and see the difference between dark blue and light blue. Keep in mind, though, even in a prokaryote, it's a double helix. But anyway, notice we're starting with two dark blue, in other words, old original DNA strands. Now, a circle or a circular chromosome has no beginning or end, really, except that there is a special place on that cell that says to the, on that chromosome, I mean, that says to the cell, this is where replication needs to start. And that place has the very descriptive name, origin of replication. That's where replication originates in all chromosomes, not just prokaryotes. But that's what's represented by the black dot. And the first thing that needs to happen after that origin of replication is recognized by the cell is that the two strands need to be separated from each other, breaking those hydrogen bonds that held them together up till then. And so that's the part. That's the first part of DNA replication. Once they're separated, and they need to be separated because each individual strand needs to be naked, in other words, I mean, in a sense, in order to be read, the code, the sequence of nucleotides needs to be read by proteins that are doing that reading. And so they need to be separated from each other. Once that happens, then the new material, represented by the light blue, gets laid down one nucleotide at a time. So this is a polymerization process, right? You're building a polymer, which nucleic acids are, by adding one nucleotide at a time to a growing sequence of nucleotides that will eventually, once it's completed, be the new strand, the light blue strand. And when you open up, or when you separate the two strands at the origin of replication, what you form is this kind of football-shaped thing called a replication bubble. Each replication bubble has two ends, the pointed ends of the football. Each of those ends is called a replication fork. It's a fork because that's the place where the two DNA strands are just now being separated. Part of it is still together and part of it has been separated, so it forms a fork. So two replication forks define one replication bubble. And as this proceeds, it just unzips bigger and bigger. So the replication bubble gets bigger and bigger, that is to say, and more new material is added, until eventually, in the case of a circular chromosome, you get all the way back to the beginning again, which is the end. And when that happens, now you have two identical double-stranded DNAs, each of which is semi-conservative, half old and half new material. And more specifically, one entire strand is original and the other entire strand is new. All right? So that's how it goes in a prokaryote, whether it's a bacterium or an archaean. In the rest of us, the eukaryotes of the world, the only real difference is the fact that there are multiple chromosomes and they are linear rather than circular. But also eukaryotic chromosomes are bigger. The genome, which is the combination of all the DNA in a cell or in an organism, but in a multicellular organism, that means in every cell as well. The genome is bigger, which means there are more genes in a typical eukaryotic cell than there are in a prokaryotic cell. So if you added up all the nucleotide base pairs in a eukaryote, it would be much more DNA spread out over however many individual chromosomes. We eukaryotes could do it exactly like a bacterium or any prokaryotic cell does it, namely in the middle of the linear chromosome, halfway down, would be the origin of replication, and it would open up and keep opening up wider and wider until you get all the way to the ends. Right? It could happen that way. But because the genome is bigger, it takes longer to do it in a eukaryote, and to speed it up as much as possible, instead of having just one origin of replication, like the prokaryotic chromosome does, there are multiple origins of replication along the length of the linear chromosome. On each chromosome, there are multiple origins of replication. And they all start out being opened at the same time. So instead of opening it one time at the middle and having to undo that until it gets all the way to the ends, each one opening up only has to open up until it runs into the other one being opened up. And therefore, you get done in a lot less time by having multiple origins of replication. So there's a replication bubble for each origin of replication, but otherwise it proceeds the same way as it does in a bacterium. And when all the bubbles have met each other, then you have the final product, two products. Just like in a prokaryotic cell, two complete double-stranded DNAs, each of which is identical to the other and to the original, except one of those double-stranded DNAs is half old material and half new material. The other one is half new material and half old material, in a sense. Yeah?
So, I mean, just back to the last slide, is the conservative model isn't possible then, right? Because you have to split the parent strand.
Well, it would be theoretically possible if you had a mechanism to separate it, to read it, but then put them back together after they're read. But it would require building the strand somewhere.
Because you're replicating two identical strands.
Yeah, you would have to be doing this to both open strands, right? So you're building two brand new strands, each one.
The only difference is it gets put back together in the conservative.
Right. In the conservative, the two originals would be put back together and the two news would be put together.
Okay.
But it doesn't happen that way. It is possible to imagine. It just doesn't happen. Okay, let's now look at the particulars of this process. We're going to be talking about several different important proteins that are involved in the process of DNA replication, and only some of them are shown in this cartoon, but every time they're shown, the book uses the same colors, which is useful. But notice we have two dark blue strands. This is the original DNA to start with, and what we're looking at here is just one replication fork. So we don't see the whole bubble. It's the other replication fork is off the screen, but there's one over here as well, forming one bubble. Okay, so the origin of replication is in the middle of the bubble. Now, there's an important, one of these important, well, I should have said when I mentioned these proteins that all but one of these proteins that we're going to name individually are not only proteins, but they are more specifically enzymes. So they're operating as catalysts. And that should be obvious for the ones that whose names end in ASE. There's one of these that isn't actually an enzyme, but it is a protein. Anyway, the first thing to act, if you want to think of this as a process, which you should, is that there needs to be one of these enzymes whose job it is to open up the replication bubble, to separate the two strands from each other at the origin of replication. And that job goes to a specific protein that is shown here just once in green, helicase. Okay, helicase is named for the fact that it unwinds the double helix. But only one helicase is shown here, off screen, you would have another helicase doing the same job in the other direction at the other replication fork. All right? And it's already been doing its job for a little bit of time, each helicase, because they started at the origin of replication, and as they proceed away from each other, each one is further unzipping the two strands in the direction of its own replication fork. Does that make sense? Okay. So helicase does the important job of separating the two strands so that they can be read. But helicase doesn't do the reading. Well, imagine what happens if helicase starts unzipping it. Why is it that the DNA strands stick together so well to begin with, before they're separated? Because they're complementary, right? One sequence is exactly perfect for the hydrogen bonds to be maximized, right? So, you can separate them pretty easily, but if you then just move out of the way, what's going to happen? They're going to immediately go back together. They're going to hydrogen bond again. So helicase does the job of separating them, but it takes something else then to keep them apart long enough so that a third protein can come in and read the sequence. And the second protein to do that job of holding them apart temporarily, kind of like a clamp, is the gray one in this figure called single-strand binding protein. That's the only one of the important proteins that isn't acting as an enzyme. It's just binding to a strand and keeping that strand from going right back together with the other strand after helicase has done its job. All right? And so you have the same thing on the other fork, which is off screen. Okay, now that they're separated and held apart temporarily, then the third protein, which is, again, an enzyme, can actually do the job of laying down new material. And that's the pink one that we see here, called primase. It's called primase because the sequence of nucleotides that it lays down is called a primer. It's a short sequence. It's only shown as two nucleotides so far. A primer is really usually 10 to 15 nucleotides in length. But it's the first stuff put down. And that stuff is called the primer, and more specifically, it's called the RNA primer, because the nucleotides that the primer is made out of are RNA nucleotides, not DNA nucleotides. Okay, so think about what you're doing here. You're trying to replicate DNA, which means if you're going to be successful, the final product needs to be nothing but DNA nucleotides. So the question arises is why you would put RNA down when you're obviously going to have to get rid of that eventually to make room for DNA. Why not just start with DNA? The answer is that there isn't a cellular mechanism for laying down DNA nucleotides unless you're adding those DNA nucleotides onto a strand that has already been started. You can't start with DNA nucleotides. You can only add DNA nucleotides to nucleotides that are already there. On the other hand, the cell can add RNA nucleotides onto nothing. They can be put down as the first nucleotides, and that's why it has to be RNA. Okay, even though the goal is DNA. So that's something the cell will have to deal with, and we'll talk about that. But the primase enzyme lays down a sequence of RNA nucleotides called the primer. Now notice that just like the overall DNA strand, each of them individually, has a 3' end and a 5' end, every individual nucleotide also has a 3' end and a 5' end, or any sequence of nucleotides of any length has a 3' end and a 5' end, right? This is really important when it comes to DNA replication because cells are able to lay down a new nucleotide only to the 3' end of a new strand. You can't add to the 5' end. That's why there is a one directional arrow here in black pointing to the left of the primer. The DNA has 3' to its right, the top strand, that is. And therefore, the RNA primer needs to be anti-parallel to that. So its 3' end is on the left in this figure. Right? I mean, correct? But the point here is that this thing can grow only in the 3' direction because you can't add any nucleotides to the 5'. This is going to present a special problem that we'll talk about more in a minute. But once the primase does its job of laying down that primer, 10 or 15 or so RNA nucleotides, then its job is done for that position of DNA. And now that the primer is there, like I said before, you can add DNA onto nucleotides once they're there. So once the DNA primer is laid down, then you can do the job of laying down DNA nucleotides, making it longer, making the strand longer. It's primer to begin with, nothing but primer. Now it's going to be primer with DNA added onto it. And that is done by a different job. That job is done by a different protein who's not pictured in this one, but whose name is DNA polymerase 3. Now, the polymerase name obviously indicates its job is to polymerize or to make a polymer. There are different categories of polymerase enzymes, though. Number 3, Roman numeral number 3 is the, in its DNA polymerase, I should say. DNA polymerase 3 is the specific one whose job it is to add DNA nucleotides one at a time to the growing strand. So it's, the first job is to add it one DNA nucleotide to the RNA primer that was just laid down. Then you add one to the previous DNA that you just laid down, and so on, one at a time to the 3' end. It's just going to make it longer.
So is the DNA polymerase just changing the uracil to thymine?
Oh, no, that's a good important point.
Because the RNA laying down those...
Nothing is being changed at all. Because the blue material is the DNA. That has the code in it, right, which is the sequence. The DNA polymerase recognizes what the nitrogenous base is. So if it sees A here, then it says, okay, I need to add a T. But it's a nucleotide by itself as raw material that comes in from the... That's just, you know, there's a pool of this in the cytosol. Or not the cytosol, the nucleoplasm, because this is occurring in the nucleus. But anyway, no, no nitrogenous bases are being changed. Just the rules of complementarity are being used so that you can call the correct kind of raw material from the surroundings. All right, now, we haven't talked about this blue thing. Helicase at each end, a different helicase copy, is continuing to unzip each replication fork, right? Now, this is kind of like unraveling a rope. If I had a rope connected to the wall and I try to separate the strands, most ropes have more than two, but just imagine it with only two strands. You know, I can just pull them apart and that will do the job up to a point, right? But notice what happens. The more I do that, the more tightly wound the rest of it becomes, right? And eventually I can't just keep pulling it like that. It's going to be over-kinked. And the same thing happens with DNA if helicase continues to unzip and nothing is done to deal with that over-coiling. And so that requires another enzyme, that's the one in blue, topoisomerase, whose job it is occasionally to cut the DNA, letting it flop around, relieving that tension, and then sewing it back together. You know, as the tension builds up, topoisomerase will cut it, ease the tension, and reform it. Same thing's happening on the other end. Okay, now, let's look at slide 14 and talk a little bit more about this polymerization process, which is what DNA polymerase 3 accomplishes. So on the left half of this figure, you have the piece of the original DNA that we're currently reading, right? This blue material has already been laid down. So DNA polymerase 3 has already done its job several times here. It added an A and then a C and then a G because it was reading T and then G and then C, right? The complementarity rules. So now the next one it's reading on the original DNA, the dark blue, is A, which means it's calling now for a T, right? Well, we've talked many times about the fact that a single nucleotide within a DNA is considered a monomer, right? But it consists of three parts. A pentose sugar, and since we're building DNA specifically, that's deoxyribose as the sugar. And then two things connected to that sugar, but at different places, right? One of which is the nitrogenous base, and the other of which is a phosphate. And it's the phosphate that is going to be covalently bonded to the sugar of the next nucleotide over and over, making up the sugar phosphate backbone. So the final product has to have nucleotides in them that have just a single phosphate. Remember that you can use another phrase for nucleotide. Nucleotide simply means that you have all three components. It means that you have the sugar, you have the nitrogenous base, and you have at least one phosphate. But the word nucleotide doesn't tell you how many phosphates, which is why it's more specific to say nucleoside monophosphate if you mean a nucleotide that has specifically one phosphate in it. And that's what each monomer of the complete DNA strand needs to be. A nucleoside monophosphate. All right? But that's not what the cell uses as raw materials. It doesn't use nucleoside monophosphates that come in one at a time and just get sewn together. Instead, the raw materials are coming in as nucleoside triphosphates. So it's the right kind of nucleoside, meaning it has the T here, which matches up to the A that's being read. But it's not a nucleoside monophosphate with a T, it's a nucleoside triphosphate. There's three phosphates. Which means to incorporate it into the DNA, two of those three phosphates are going to have to be removed, right? Which seems overcomplicated. Why not just bring it in as a nucleoside monophosphate, which is what you want it to be, and just sew it together? Well, obviously, there are reasons for everything that happens in biology. What is the reason that it has to come in as a nucleoside triphosphate rather than as a nucleoside monophosphate? Exactly. Think about what ATP is. ATP is, it uses ribose instead of deoxyribose, but ATP is an example of a nucleoside triphosphate, right? And what is ATP famous for? Carrying energy. So when you bring this next one in, this T-carrying nucleoside triphosphate, two of the phosphates of those three get cleaved off, and that releases energy. Why is energy needed? Because DNA replication is an anabolic process. You're building big things, right, out of small. And that is an endergonic process. It's an uphill battle energetically. So, yeah, it would be nice to be able to bring it in as a nucleoside monophosphate, but it's never going to happen because you can't force this thing to... you don't have the energy to force that to happen. You do have the energy if you bring in a high energy molecule and release some of that energy to form that bond. And so that's exactly what happens. Under the catalytic action of DNA polymerase 3, it's not listed as 3 here, but it specifically is 3. Okay? Now that is going to result in two phosphates that are still stuck together but no longer associated with any carbon, because they're just phosphates on themselves. Remember, each phosphate is a phosphorus and four oxygens. No carbon, though. So that's what the I, once again, stands for, inorganic. When you have two inorganic phosphates that are still stuck together, we call that pyrophosphate. But that doesn't actually last very long. As soon as that pyrophosphate leaves, the two individual phosphates in that pyrophosphate separate into individual inorganic phosphates that we're used to seeing. Okay, so that is what provides the energy for polymerization and the DNA polymerase 3 enzyme provides the catalytic activity to make this happen quickly. Notice also that this is happening at the 3' end of the new strand, because that's the only end that you can ever add new nucleotides to. Okay. Now to 15. Here we're looking at, in the yellow shaded box, one replication bubble with two replication forks. But there's really that one bubble has four regions, four quadrants, like the quadrants of a mathematical graph. Okay, so upper left, upper right, lower left. I'm splitting it into four quadrants because two of these quadrants are doing one thing, exactly the same, but in opposite corners, and the other two that are diagonally away from each other are doing a slightly different thing, but the same as each other. Now, all of it has in common that new DNA is being added. But the reason that there are slightly different things that are happening in each of the two diagonals is because of what we've been talking about in terms of adding new DNA nucleotides. It can only be added to the 3' end. All right. Now look what happens when you have a replication fork, like we see in detail in the middle here. This is where helicase is opening up more and more, right? But because of anti-parallel nature of DNA, this top strand of the dark blue is 5' on the left and off screen, 3' on the other end. The other one is 3' on the left, 5' on the right. So when you're opening this up, you can't treat these two templates the same way because they're running in opposite directions. One of these new strands, the one that's being built on the top strand here, and this really technically should be light blue, the book made an error because this is new material. But anyway, this new strand that's being built is being built in the direction that the fork is opening up. So everything's going well for this one. You just open it up further and further, and you can keep adding new nucleotides to this 3' end. But you can't do that with the other strand, because the other strand will have a primer on it in which the 3' end, which is the only end you can add DNA nucleotides to, is facing toward the right, and the fork is opening up to the left. It's backwards. So that's why we distinguish two kinds of strands in this bubble: the so-called lagging strands and the leading strands. The two leading strands, which are diagonal from each other, are the ones that are opening, that are being built in the same direction that the fork is opening up. And so the leading strands happen more easily. And each leading strand requires only one primer, the original primer that was laid down when there was nothing yet. And then as soon as you have that, since the fork is opening up in the direction it's moving, you just keep adding DNA. Make it in just one shot, basically. The lagging strands, and lagging means falling behind, taking longer, those lagging strands need to be made piecewise, not just as one big piece that gets longer and longer, but as many individual pieces, each requiring its own primer. Right? Each individual piece is going to require its primer because you have to put a primer down before you can add to it. So for the lagging strand, you open up, the helicase opens it up far enough so that you have some exposed. Then you lay down a primer onto nothing. And then you add DNA nucleotides in the 3' direction, which is opposite of the way the fork is opening, until you run into the previous one that you just made, previous fragment. And these fragments are called Okazaki fragments, which we can see in slide 16. Oh, I guess we can't. We will in the next picture. This shows you what's labeled 1 and 2 are Okazaki fragments, but that we'll see them again in the next slide. Each one of these, though, since it's built in the opposite direction compared to how the strands are opening up, needs to be built with its own primer. Then you add DNA until you run into the previous primer that was laid down. Then it's going to open up here, and one that would be labeled 4, because this is 3 really, would have its own primer and then run into this one over and over. Those are called Okazaki fragments. And the same exact thing has to happen diagonally to that for the same reason, but on the other original strand of DNA. So you have two leading strands diagonally apart and two lagging strands diagonally apart. Okay, well, in 17, we can see the word Okazaki, just named after a dead man. We see the pink primase enzyme laying down the primer, right? Once that's done, then RNA polymerase, which is the orangish one, DNA polymerase 3 comes along and adds DNA to the 3' end, making it longer and longer. But in the case of the lagging strand, since this is happening in the other direction, you only add DNA until you run into the previous Okazaki fragment that was laid down a little earlier. So by the time this is done, by the time all the nucleotides have been added, meaning that there's no more space, no more DNA nucleotides that don't have corresponding nucleotides that are new next to them, then you have a couple problems you need to take care of. One problem is that it's not entirely DNA, right? As we said before. So there's no spaces left. All the spaces have been filled up with nucleotides, but some of those nucleotides are RNA. The primers are made of RNA. They can't be allowed to remain in the final product. So that's one problem that needs to be taken care of, and that requires yet another important enzyme. And that enzyme, which is the one shown in yellow here, is called DNA polymerase 1. So it's a different version of DNA polymerase, but it still does largely the same job, meaning it's able to read a nucleotide and put down the correct complementary DNA nucleotide. The double duty that it does, though, is that it removes the RNA nucleotide that's there as part of the primer and then replaces it with the appropriate DNA version, still complementary to the original DNA. So that's what yellow's doing. And that's doing it for all the RNA primers, one in each leading strand, and many primers in each lagging strand. They all, though, require the action of DNA polymerase 1 to replace that RNA with DNA. That's not the end of it, though, because when DNA polymerase 1, the yellow one here, gets to the last RNA nucleotide of each primer, it's able to replace the DNA. I mean, it's able to take the RNA and replace it with DNA. But it's not able to make the final covalent bond. Because to make this thing an intact strand, all of the nucleotides need to be held together with covalent bonds, right? Once this one gets replaced, it's not able to make that final covalent bond between the phosphate and the sugar. So there's a little gap, basically. And making that final bond for each of those little nicks in corresponding to each primer requires yet another enzyme, the one that's teal-colored on the bottom. And its name is ligase, or DNA ligase. Remember, we've talked about ligands. To ligate means to bind together. And ligands are things that bind other things. Well, ligase is called this because it binds these pieces that haven't been covalently bonded together yet, end to end, together. Okay, and once that happens for all of these primers, you now have the situation where it's entirely DNA, there's no RNA left, plus each strand is continuous, unbroken from one end to the other. And therefore, you now have two double-stranded DNAs identical to each other and identical to the original. '18 is really not new information. This just brings it all together in one summary picture. So for each replication bubble, remember there's several replication bubbles for each linear eukaryotic chromosome. This is just one of them. But each replication bubble features helicase opening it up, primase laying down the RNA primers, single-strand binding protein, I should have said that before primase, really, single-strand binding protein clamping it open so that they don't just sew back together, undoing the job of helicase. And then primase lays down the primer. Then DNA polymerase 3 lays down DNA nucleotides, making each little segment longer. That's happening just for one primer on each leading strand, and it's happening for several different primers on each lagging strand, corresponding to Okazaki fragments. And then DNA polymerase 1 comes along and removes the RNA, replaces it with the appropriate DNA. And then DNA ligase comes along and makes sure that those final covalent bonds are made so that it's all one continuous polymer for each of the two strands. Okay, any questions on that? That's the overall process of DNA replication. Yeah?
How come there's no DNA polymerase 2?
Well, it's not that there isn't any. It's just not involved in this. So like other things, they name them in the order they're discovered, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're involved that way. Just like photosystem 2 comes before photosystem 1. Okay, 19. Well, this actually is a nice answer to your question. One of the things that DNA polymerase 2 is involved in is what we're seeing here. It's not the only thing that DNA polymerase 2 is involved in, but there are other things involved besides DNA polymerase 2 doing this job. But the job that we're looking at here is proofreading. Now, each individual chromosome is millions of nucleotides long, using humans as an example. Plus, there are 46 of those that need to be made in a diploid organism, right? There's 23 kinds of chromosomes. Each of those needs, in a diploid cell, there's two of each of those. And those all need to be replicated perfectly. So it's many, many millions of times that this process has to repeat itself without any errors at all. Which, if you compare this to any industrial process, for instance, or any kind of human-made process, you would be bragging if you said we make one error every million times. Like the post office, if they were to say this, for instance, or a factory, that would be a hell of an accomplishment. Well, one error in a million is actually way too many when it comes to DNA, because that means there would be several errors every generation, every cell cycle. And you have many cell cycles that make you an organism that has 100 trillion cells, right? So you'd be full of errors if it were only one in a million chance. Well, actually, it does happen that there is accidents that occur, but what makes the overall rate much lower than one in a million is that the vast majority of those mistakes, as they occur, are recognized. So mistakes happen, but mistakes are repaired as they happen. And that's what I'm calling the DNA proofreading mechanism, which is a system of enzymes doing the job of reading the new product and making sure that everything is okay. So this happens when DNA is made brand new. In other words, it checks to make sure if there was a T here, it needs to be an A. And, you know, by mistake, a C could have been added. Well, that needs to be removed and replaced. Happens not only in replication, though, when new DNA is made. It also happens throughout your lifetime. For instance, we talked about the fact that ultraviolet radiation can cause cancer, skin cancer from sunlight. The reason that is so likely is that high-energy ultraviolet radiation hitting the nucleus in skin cells will actually change the chemical nature of the DNA. And the most likely way that this happens is by forming what is called a thymine-thymine dimer. Dimer is a two-part thing, like a polymer is many parts and monomer is one part. It's most likely between two thymines, which is one of the four kinds of nucleotides, right? If they're right beside each other in the sequence, within one strand, thymine and then another thymine. And when that happens, a dimer forms between the two thymines that are on the same strand. Remember, nucleotides that are on the same strand are not connected at all normally, right? They're not holding the strand together. They're hanging off of the strand. The sugar phosphate backbone is what's holding it together. So you don't want interaction between adjacent nucleotides within the strand. But UV radiation causes this to happen. We see a dimer forming right here, which is it causes a little buckle in it and allows it to, it disallows it from being properly read when that forms. So this is one example of a problem in the overall mechanism that proofreading needs to come to the rescue for. Well, this is a nuclease, this green thing, another kind of enzyme. Nuclease is a general term. It simply refers to an enzyme whose job it is to break nucleotide bonds between nucleotides. So it can cut a strand of DNA. And it needs to do that because when you recognize that there is one of these dimers or some other problem, a dimer is not the only problem. It could also recognize that, for instance, the wrong nucleotide has been laid down rather than the complementary one. But if there's a problematic stretch of DNA, the first thing that needs to be done is that offending sequence needs to be cut out or excised, which means cut out. So this is called excision repair. And the nuclease is the enzyme that does the excising, or the cutting out. So it cuts this bond, it cuts this bond, so that this whole thing can be taken out. That leaves a gap, of course, but that's not a problem because you're only removing that from the one strand, right? You still have the original strand to work with, and the original strand is how you knew how to build that new strand to begin with. So all you need to do is read that section again and lay down the right kinds of DNAs to make it a brand new stretch, just like before that thymer happened. That thymine dimer happened. So this is another job of DNA polymerases, including two, but also one is shown here. They're both involved in the proofreading mechanism. But just like the normal job of DNA ligase, DNA polymerase one, whose job it was to remove the RNA. Here it's removing DNA and adding DNA, but it still can't make that final covalent bond. So after DNA polymerase does its job, then you need DNA ligase, just like you did originally, to sew it together. And once that happens, it's like nothing ever happened. It's perfectly new, perfectly functional DNA. Now, and that's what happens most of the time. An impressively high rate, or impressively low rate of errors. Yeah.
The dimer only happens with thymine?
No, it's just more. It's by far most easy for chemical reasons for it to happen between thymines, especially with the energy of UV. They're just kind of a perfect match. But there's UV is not the only thing that can form these. You know, there's chemicals are carcinogens if they cause cancer in one way or another. But cancer in general starts out as something wrong with the DNA, right? Because what's going to happen because of that defect in DNA is a loss of the control of the cell cycle, and it becomes cancerous. Okay. Let's go to 20. We're done with the overall process, but what we see in 20 is something that is problematic for eukaryotes, but that prokaryotes don't have to worry about at all. And that's because of this difference we've already talked about. A prokaryotic cell has a circular chromosome, so no ends. A eukaryotic chromosome has two ends, and those two ends are problematic for one of the two strands involved. Well, on this piece of DNA, we're only looking at the left end of this that fades off, but at the other end, you would have a 3' end at the top and a 5' end at the bottom, right? So it would be, you know what I'm saying. So the same problem is happening on both ends, but it's happening to just one of the two strands, and on the other end, it's happening to the other strand. The problem here, though, is the inability to lay down DNA onto nothing, which is why you need the primers to begin with, right? So if you've reached all the way to the end, you've opened up the bubble, you've exposed this end, then RNA, I mean the primase enzyme, whose job it is to lay down the RNA, can lay down that primer no problem. Because you don't need anything to build the primer onto. You just lay it down, right? That's okay, and then you can add the DNA up into the next primer, like you see here. But then when DNA polymerase 1 comes along, what's its job? What is it? Well, it uses the code, but what's the specific job of polymerase 1? That's right. So the primer needs to go, right, because it's RNA. DNA polymerase 1 can remove it, but when it removes it from this very end, there's no piece of strand already there that you can build it, build the DNA onto, right? So you're back to your problem of not having anything to lay down DNA to, and therefore this part just remains empty, which means the new strand is slightly longer than the original, I mean slightly shorter than the original strand, because you can't add it, DNA all the way to the end. All right. Now this is a problem for eukaryotes only, because they're the only ones that have these ends. Now, this isn't necessarily a problem immediately, because your DNA contains your genes, of course, right? For humans, roughly 20,000. But what might surprise you is that the combination of all your genes in terms of number of DNA nucleotides, your genes represent only about 2% of your total DNA. Most of your DNA is actually sequences between the genes that we're still learning about how it works, but it's not working as genes. The genes are separated by sequences that are also DNA, just like the genes themselves, but they are intervening sequences between these genes. Including DNA that's on the ends. DNA on the ends is not genes. It's not inside a gene. All right. This is by analogy. It's becoming almost an old-fashioned analogy now, because now cinema is digital. But in the days of film movies with frames, right? Frames that are projected. You all still remember frames of movies, right? Okay. To project it, you need to load it into a projector. The film is a long strip of frames, right? And so there needs to be a length of film that allows you to get it all the way through the projector and onto the take-up reel before you get to the first frame, right? And then you have the countdown or whatever, and then the first frame of the movie. Well, the first frame of the movie is like the first gene. It is actually doing an important job, coding for a protein, right? The leader, as it's called, before that, is not important, really. It's kind of disposable. And in fact, in a popular movie that you've been projected a lot of times, the projectionist has usually afraid the end. And to make it new, you snip it off a little bit at a time. It's no problem as long as you have enough leader. But if this is happening for over and over, eventually you'd be cutting into the film itself, right? You wouldn't have the whole movie anymore, because you'd cut off some actual frames of the movie. Like, you would be cutting off genes eventually if this happened, because every cell cycle, every cellular generation, the eukaryotic chromosome gets shorter because of these ends not being able to go all the way to the end. Obviously, that would be a problem, right? It means that the species would go extinct, because eventually you'd be cutting into things that are so important that cells wouldn't be able to live. Okay? Obviously, there must be some way around this that has evolved, because we exist. And there has been something that has evolved. Namely, another enzyme that has come into existence called telomerase. Now, telomerase gets its name from the fact that these ends of a eukaryotic chromosome, each of the two ends, is called a telomere. Telo means far, so they're at the farthest parts from the middle, telomeres. And telomerase, who's named after the telomeres, operates at each telomere. And it does so by adding a kind of a prefab sequence of DNA nucleotides, making the strand a little bit longer. In other words, adding leader that is just basically stuff that you can cut off for a while and not be in trouble, and then you add more later, and this will allow indefinite numbers of cell cycles without actually cutting into the genes. Okay, so that's the job of telomerase. Prokaryotes don't have to worry about that because they don't have any ends. That brings us to really just one slide left, even though it's two in the presentation. I say that because 21 and 22 are really, in the book, all one figure. And what you need to know about this figure is that as we go from left to right, we are zooming out. So we're really up close here on the left edge, and then we're zooming out as we go farther and farther to the next slide as well. But what's shown in these two pictures, or one overall picture, is the organization at the molecular level of DNA within a eukaryotic nucleus. So it's pretty amazing how much DNA gets packed into a cell that is so small it's invisible. And not only is it within that invisibly tiny cell, all of that DNA is in just a tiny fraction of that cell, the nucleus, which is even much smaller than the cell itself. So 46 chromosomes, millions of nucleotides long, get packed into a tiny nucleus. Whereas if you were to just stretch it all out, the DNA, I don't mean forcibly stretch it, I just mean lay it all out so that it's one line, it would be over a meter long for each cell. And that's packed into the nucleus of an invisible cell. The reason that it's able to be packed together is that DNA is packaged along with what other component that together make up chromatin. What is chromatin? It's inside what? Chromatin is the name of a mixture of two things. Chromatin is the stuff that I said eventually, once it condenses to the point that you see individual pieces, we call them chromosomes, right? But chromatin as a material is really two kinds of molecules forming a mixture. What are the two kinds of molecules?
DNA and proteins.
DNA and proteins, right. Both of which we see in this figure. And specifically, the main kind of protein that makes up the protein component of chromatin is a group of proteins called histones. So the blue here is obviously the DNA, right? To make it more compact, so that you don't have over a meter long, but you can fit it into a nucleus, the enormously long DNA double helix gets wound around histone proteins that are grouped together in sets of eight. Okay? An individual histone is one of these purple things. Kind of looks like a sperm. When you have, and they're all identical. When you get eight of these histones together, each with a tail, and you put them together at their heads in this arrangement, with the eight tails sticking out radially, you really have what in effect is a hose reel or a spool. Those tails form the arms of a spool. And therefore, a part of the overall length of the DNA can wrap around that spool so many times. All right? That forms what is called one nucleosome. One nucleosome is eight histone proteins forming one spool, and the length of DNA that's wrapped by that spool. That's only a tiny fraction of the overall length of the DNA, so there's not just one nucleosome, there are many, many nucleosomes along the length of the chromosome. And we can see by this photomicrograph that it looks like beads on a string. That's what textbooks often describe it as, beads on a string. Those beads are the nucleosomes, and the pieces of string between the beads is the DNA that's not wound between two nucleosomes. Okay, so that alone greatly reduces the overall length. But it needs to be much more compacted than that in order to be managed. So the nucleosomes themselves then get amassed into a much thicker strand. And that makes it, that's one more level of compactness. If we then keep going in 22, that already thicker strand with all of those many, many nucleosomes and the DNA wound around it, then it starts looping back and forth, forming an even thicker strand. And that is what makes up the thing that we can properly call a chromosome at that point, because the chromosome is so compact that we see it distinct from all the other pieces, 22 other pieces in a human, or in a diploid cell, 45 other pieces, all of which fit within that microscopically small nucleus. Okay. Now, remember that you would not see this chromosome until it, because it wouldn't be compact enough, you would just see it as diffuse chromatin in a nucleus. The nucleus would just look gray, all one color, because you don't see any distinct chromosomes. But you wouldn't see it as a chromosome until after the S phase has already been completed in the cell cycle. And the S phase is when this DNA replication we've just been studying in this chapter has occurred, right? So you don't see it as a chromosome until it's already a replicated chromosome, which is why this is made up of two sister chromatids identical to each other and joined together at the centromere of that replicated chromosome, right? So that's enough DNA for two chromosomes, one for each of the two cells that the cell will eventually split into when it gets to the M phase. But that's not enough DNA for an entire cell. That's enough DNA of this chromosome type for two cells. Then you have other chromosomes that are different from this one, carrying different kinds of genes, but they're all replicated as well. Okay. Now, do I want to start the next chapter within the last 2 minutes?
I don't think so.
Let me see what the slide is. Probably don't. No, we'll stop there. Yeah.
So, I'm just having a hard time understanding what the real point of the RNA primer is, because all of these three can come in and lay down all the nucleic acid or bases that you need. What's the point of having those gaps? Like, why not just stick the nomad and just go straight to pulp?
Like I said, there's no way the cell can accomplish it chemically.
So is the primer really more so for the direction?
The primer is just to lay something down so that you can add DNA to it.
But so is polymerase 3, though, isn't it? I mean, polymerase 3 is adding the rest of that backbone and the base onto it, right?
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that when the primer is laid down, there's nothing that it's being added to. It's the first thing being laid down. And the cell can only do that with RNA.
So
that's why you have to start with RNA and then replace it.
So then, I mean, it is more so for the direction of the replication,
right? Well, the direction it happens for either RNA or DNA. The direction is simply determined by the fact that it's anti-parallel. So each primer is going to be anti-parallel to the strand that it's associated with. But even if you were able to start with DNA, that would be the same way. Right, because adding new DNA requires an already existing strand that you just make longer.
Okay.
Think of it like a oyster making a pearl. Something has to get inside first, and then
right, that piece of strand sand is like the RNA primer,
and then
you can build up the nacre or whatever is made out of it.
Good analogy.
Yes. Well, and the. Except that it wouldn't do it at all. It's an irritant, right? It's trying to protect its body
right. From
that sharp piece of sand.
Just think about that. Right?
But yes, it has to have a starting point. You can't. It would never just make a pearl by laying down pearl material onto nothing.
Exactly.
It has to add it to something that's already there. And that's why you need the primers. And as we'll see, once we go into transcription, the other job of RNA, the goal of transcription is to make an RNA molecule, right? A messenger RNA. So in that case, it is a more direct process because the RNA that you have to lay down is what you want.